Keep going. I gotta go to the bathroom.
Outrage culture, go.
We can... No, just pee. We can come it. Back. We'll, if we have a, that's just what editing is for.
Welcome to the Ancestral Mind Podcast. My name is Colin Slugger, founder and CEO of Wild Foods Co. and ancestralmind.com. We're here to cover all things from an ancestral health perspective so you can build your daily life while considering the first principles of what makes you the sexy human beast that you are, Brent Philbin.
Yes, thank you.
And we have
you
another.
Went to me very quickly that time. Thank
we have
you.
Another sexy beast on the show today, Chris Lynn.
I don't know if I subscribe to sexy, but I definitely will take beast.
He's going for that aged sexy look.
Wow.
A little bit of the gray in the beard coming in.
Yeah. Well, you know, at this point in my life, I'm just happy I have hair on my head. So if it wants to come out anywhere else, I'll just go with it.
So today's show is sponsored by Wild Foods. Will you please take it away with our ad?
Oh, we're throwing in early today. All right.
Yeah, might as well
get out of the way. Ready. This episode is brought to you by Wild Foods Co. Real foods, real ingredients, and you get them in real time. If you go to wildfoods.co and use the code AM Podcast 12, we'll get them over to you as fast as humanly possible or ancestrally possible.
I feel like when you're doing the ad, I wanted to be like a conductor. Like, coupon, you know, like throw it in.
I'm incredibly jealous of your radio
I know,
voice.
He's got a radio voice, I know.
It's pretty impressive.
It's crazy. So today's show, like, we're just like, oh, midday, I'm not feeling super great. I don't know if I'm even going to go to the gym today. Today is my racquetball day. And so I was like, let's just go record something and talk about some random stuff. We have quite a few topics to talk about, and this is just a general show about general stuff.
Okay.
And so actually, the feedback we got from some of our listeners was we need to have some shows that are more work family safe, right?
Yes.
And I was suspecting that. Now, I want to have some shows that aren't going to be that way because I like to just be able to let loose and just crush it, right? But some shows we do need to be conscious of that because we do want to tap into the younger audience. A lot of these ideas are applicable to all humans. And so today's show, I don't think it's going to be one of those shows. What do you think?
You don't think it's going to be family-friendly?
I mean, we got three adults here talking about random topics. Like, maybe we'll say today's show is an experiment and we're going to try to keep it work-family safe, but we're not sure, so don't hold us to that.
Can I ask the question, what is work-safe-friendly?
I guess not cursing that much, like, or at all.
I drop really F-bombs a lot, so I think
I've been getting on him
that's
that.
Been coming through on the show. We had some entire segments we had to kind of cut out that were related to Jeff Bezos and some things that people were trying to blackmail him with.
As the resident old guy here, I'm still kind of amazed when I'm watching cable TV late at night and I hear the SH word come out and I think to myself, am I watching cable? Oh no, that's Comedy Central. So I just want to make sure in this kind of changing environment, I know what we're actually aiming for.
Yeah, we're aiming to not use the F word. And I basically told Brent that the S word or the A word here and there. It sounds so weird to say
we're
that.
Saying A word.
Sounds God. So weird. The S and the A word.
Colin,
is okay
say,
here and there.
You can say awesome when you're talking about me. That's an appropriate word.
But let's just try to keep it. Actually, today we're probably already going to fail with that, but that's fine. Okay, what else were we talking about earlier today? And what do we really want to cover today, Brent? You got the show notes in front of you?
Well, yeah, I got the show notes in front of me. We're going to, I'm watching you populate these with just some of the most random ideas. Like everything from people suck to how we're struggling to do more work and stuff like that.
Today, I have a lot of stuff on here. I told, you know, like I had a cross the gym back and forward. I want to talk about that a little bit. I want to tie it into just people. I think the topic for today will be people and kind of human behavior because we are still animals that have a set of genes that think we're going to live in the wild. Yet right. We live in this modern world and all the stuff that goes along with that. And as a result, you see a lot of the same trends, whether that's in relationships, whether that's in workplace, whether that's in drama and gossip, and now social media thrown into it and all the nonsense you get. And like all this can be traced back to an understanding from an evolutionary perspective, right? Evolutionary psychology is a whole branch of, I don't know, is it natural science? Would that be a physical science? Probably natural science. Maybe you know, Chris.
No, I think it's more of a conceptual science, like theoretical science. Yeah, because basically what you're saying, evolutionary biology is the study of how the biology subjectively kind of diverts from the science. So choices that different subsets of society has made over time.
It's one of my favorite topics. Like when we were doing the cognitive bias show, and when we can tie ancestral principle into the things that we see on a daily basis, that stuff just gives me goosebumps, bombs. Bomb dropping. All right.
I feel like we didn't give Chris the chance to give his elevator pitch of himself.
He doesn't really have one.
We skipped over that. We just said this, Chris.
Because I know him well enough to know that he won't really, he'll give the most vague, mysterious answer ever. But you know what? Go for it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that the funny part about this whole, you know, endeavor working with Wild Foods and getting a chance to explore these topics is these are things that candidly are really top of mind in a lot of different places. Colin, you call yours the ancestral mind. You know, I spent a lot of time in San Francisco in technology. You know, kind of a well-known secret is that most of the best and most prolific investors are all philosophy majors in college.
Yep.
And so one of the things that most really kind of introspectful people are asking, both intellectually, physically, and emotionally, is kind of, you know, how am I different than the rest of society or other people that come before me? What am I doing today that's kind of like what they did? And what can I learn from past behaviors or opportunities? And so the reality is, whether you're thinking about it from a evolutionary standpoint, whether you think about sociology or whether you think about philosophy, right? I mean, it's amazing the capacity and the interest that human beings have at evaluating other human beings in similar situations, making choices and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And what's crazy about it is, like we talk about, we're actually built to do things. We're not built to think long-term. We talked about it earlier today, right? We got to be in the present, in the now, because that is a survival trait. And I use the example of the three kind of modern day hunter gatherers, apparently, that were brought to an island that was civilized and that had maybe cars. I think it was like in the '60s or something. And they were, it might've been Australia. Aboriginals, you know, it might've been them or like one of those Polynesian islands around. And so a scientist had created a relationship with them, and he was somehow able to bring them from their island or wherever they were.
Was this Crocodile Dundee?
Maybe. Yes. Quite the philosopher and scientist, anthropologist, I should say. But what he said is these three guys, I guess they were like literally in like hunter-gatherer attire, like a loincloth or whatever they had. And they were dropped into this island where there was like buildings and concrete and all these things. And he said he tried talking to them because he knew their native language, and they couldn't even speak because they were so enamored by what they were looking at. Like their brain just couldn't even really conceptualize it. He said that they literally disappeared for 3 days and just walked around the entire island to absorb every ounce of everything. And then he came back and like they just unleashed the floodgates of like things that he didn't even realize were on the island, or things that they might have done, or just observations from a wild person that is so used to just being in nature and observing all the minute details that you see in that kind of state. That again is a way to find food. It's a way to see threats before they, like average people like us would not see threats that a hunter-gatherer would see, right? Like we wouldn't last a day for most of us, right? And I thought it was just fascinating that like they couldn't even speak, like they wouldn't even talk to the guy. He was like trying to get them to say something, and they were just so like, no, we're going to go and absorb what's here and like get a lay of the land, and then we'll come back and talk to you, right? And I just thought that was a fascinating anecdote. So today's topic are many, but I wanted to talk about people. And so I have some of these kind of thrown out here, like, you know, the sickness of being famous, external validation, that's one point. How evolutionary biology and psychology tie into your relationships. And obviously like the Sex 3.0 episodes is going to be a good treatment of that. But what are you thinking, Brant? Like, what are you feeling today?
Well, you wrote down here talking about your CrossFit gym. So that might be a fine place to start.
That's quite a thing to unpack.
It, well, obviously the thing is huge, but what was your, you clearly had an issue with people that you want to talk about with the CrossFit gym.
Issues.
And I understood that from the casino perspective. Like, I've done the casino manager thing, and I have a unique look at people when they're basically at their worst. Honestly, I feel like when people are at a gym, it's almost like when they're at their best, right? So maybe they're contrasting, but still people, you know, suck overall. So,
well, it's not even that people suck. It's more about like, let's understand why humans tend to repeat the same mistakes.
Okay.
People have written books about them. We have interviews, we have shows, we have people doing events where they speak, we have therapy.
I also think it's fascinating though that you guys have taken, you know, health and fitness and gambling, right? Two things that are like, they know no bounds. Like it is a global phenomenon, both of those things. And some would posit that they're just two sides of the same coin. But it's fascinating that, you know, there are a couple things that humans do the world over. I think gambling is something that's been around for as long as there's been people, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure there was a guy watching Cain and Abel fight going, hey, I got $5 on Cain.
It actually is interesting. Maybe a whole show could be on like the origins of gambling, because that's actually something
I never really thought about the origins.
I don't really know why we do that, you know? Like, I know that hunter-gatherers always had games and we had rituals and we'd have ceremonies. There's a lot of things we would do and they would always explain something, but I don't really understand what gambling would have done for us.
I think that the thing you have to realize is that as we are, you know, discussing things like you know, the biological imperatives of being a mammal and having to exist, like the difference is that we have rational thought, right? And so, mm-hmm. you know, you're sit there with this huge kind of tool on top of your shoulders, and thoughts come in and out of it all day, right? And I have to imagine that, you know, after you've tracked your wildebeest and, you know, you've slaughtered your meat for the week and you've done all of these things, you're probably still, you know, you got 15 hours of, you know, staring at the sky or staring at the yeah. you know, the cave. And so in those moments, the thing that kind of differentiates us is our ability, you know, to have rational thought. And I got to imagine, you know, it was probably not very profound. I'm sure it was, you know, one cave dweller to the next, looking at the third guy trying to start a fire and guy going, I bet you he's never going to start the fire.
We'll see. And I wonder if that is when that the origins of that would have happened when we were hunter-gatherers or when we started having the concept of property. Because if you think about like the idea of gambling, you kind of have to win something. If you're in an egalitarian society where no one even has the idea that like this is my thing because it's everybody's thing, could you actually gamble in that setting?
You could just be right about something too. So I think the reason that people are drawn to gambling is they think they know better than all the other people around them, which is just the Dunning-Kruger, I think, right? Where you overestimate your own mm-hmm. abilities. That's one of the cognitive biases that we didn't talk about. So if you think you know better than everybody else and somebody else thinks they know better than you and you're willing to wager something on the outcome or just be right, like, okay, I'll fight this person if I'm wrong or you'll fight this person if you're right. I don't know. It'd be interesting to look back on the history of gambling. I mean,
because
I know
books that
like playing cards have been around for
a long time. In fact, that was a Japanese company, I believe, starting like the 13, 14 or 1500s.
Yeah, I'm sure. But even before
It was Nintendo. They were a card game company.
Oh, really?
In like way, way long ago. Sure, and they transitioned into video games and then became what they
became. The ultimate pivots.
But I got to think that go back to a hunter, right? I mean, I got to imagine that, yes, there are probably guys that were out there or women hunting, right? And they did it as a function of, I'm hungry, I'm going to go get some food. But I got to imagine that there's probably one guy who just like killing the stuff. And yeah. he liked the challenge. And he maybe he wouldn't go after a deer. He would go after a saber-toothed tiger or whatever. And I think that's the core of kind of the differentiation between doing things strictly for a biological imperative and then kind of having this rational thought and saying, hey, what if? Hey, mm-hmm. Colin, do you think I can go, you know, kill that lion?
I think, again, the question begs to be asked, when did we start having more free time to think about those things? Because from what I've been able to hear, like an example of the Polynesian guys visiting the island, it seems like we were always supremely in the moment because that was just kind of a survival thing. We were either gossiping and like having relationships, like being with people, or we were hunting and walking around and like having to literally observe everything. Where's food? Where's danger, et cetera. And it seems like we would have had, in fact, this is when you get to like Terrence McKenna stuff, where a lot of our use of psychedelics, he postulates, is it postulate? Is that the word where you hypothesize, yeah. postulate? That is when we started really doing like cave paintings and when our brains were able to evolve and grow and when we had that detachment of ego and maybe even detachment of the present to go into these like long journeys of thought and it just kind of is supposed to apparently expanded our consciousness and awareness drastically.
Think about this. Think about the first people that got high or the first people that had a trip from eating a mushroom or smoking a plant.
They say he thinks it was like the chimps and the Australopithecus.
Think about how much other random shit they would have smoked to just be like, I wonder if this thing does something better because they don't know.
Well, yeah. Once humans had control of fire, I'm sure we probably smoked everything we could possibly could. Like, definitely.
I mean, we did. I mean, I think we still continue in some respects.
Right. So anyways, we were trying to talk about people and then we got into gambling. Now, the thing with the CrossFit gym is like, I had people that would come to the gym every day. We had your hardcore clients. And the thing that most fascinated me at the time and still kind of does to this day is the fact that like, they would always want more equipment. They would always, like that was just an obsession. Like the true hardcore CrossFitter wants like all the equipment in the world in the gym. Like, and if they see you do anything outside of that from like a business purchase perspective, like if you had to put up a nice TV or get some whiteboards, or like I literally remember we bought some PVC pipes because you use them for warming up, right? Okay. And they were from Rogue and they were like $3 each and it saved us the hassle of having to get them from Home Depot. So I'm like, let's just buy like 15 of them, right? We need them for classes. I had people that were complaining saying we should buy barbells instead. And I was like, I couldn't even get one barbell for the cost of all those PVC pipes. And it's like, that's the kind of shit. It was like, people were never happy. If you bought barbells, they're like, well, we actually need more bumper plates. You should have got those instead. If you got a female barbell, they're like, well, we need more guy barbells. It was never ending, like this pit, this hole of like satisfying humans and what they want. And no matter what we threw into that pit, nobody was ever happy. And I just feel like that was always so fascinating to me. And if Josh is listening to this, my ex-partner, he's probably just like smiling, smirking. He's probably still dealing with it today. And I know how much money he's been invested in that business.
I wonder, so CrossFit gyms are pretty expensive as far as gyms
go, they're actually
right?
The opposite. They're the cheapest thing you can have in the fitness industry.
From the consumer perspective. So
yes.
They pay, what was the average?
It's like 150, 125.
Like 150, yeah. So, whereas they wouldn't complain if they went to Planet Fitness.
Yeah, but also you go to Planet Fitness and you have $1 million in equipment on the floor.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
So, like, you know, it's, I don't know if that's really the thing to address here. I think it's more of the mindset of how people kind of like, you know, they feel like it's their gym. They feel like they want to have a say. And we're just over here trying to run a business and actually make some profit. And like, we're constantly trying to like balance, should we buy equipment this month or like save some money for taxes or improve that, like, get another bathroom or shower, or whatever. And it's like, when we actually got to the point where we had 4 showers, all of which we had to pay plumbing for, permitting, et cetera, people still just wanted more equipment. And it's just like insane. But if we didn't get those 4 bathrooms, they'd probably complain about that. So I guess the overarching topic here is like, why are humans always unhappy and hard to please? And why do we always seek more, 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 more?
Well, the question, I guess, is it something in our biology or is it something that is it a learned behavior?
I think it's in our biology. It's too prevalent to not be. Like, what, it's too universal.
What would the ancestral reason behind entitlement be?
Well, I don't even know if entitlement, that's its own thing. I think it's more of a, entitlement's more a sociological kind of modern day thing that is, our genes just haven't been able to deal with. But I think the idea for more, we can trace back to evolution. Like, if you have more resources, you increase the chances that you can have more offspring and they can survive. Like, that's 101.
Better mate, right? I mean, it's like, I'm always amazed by watching these, like, you know, birds that are in the middle of the Amazon, right? And they have this incredibly ornate plume and then they have this dance, right? And it's all built around this notion of attracting this mate, right? And
serves no utility outside of that usually.
Yeah,
exactly, right? But if you think about like all of these things, I think the evolution of kind of, you know, human accumulation has always been predicated on that. And the irony is you have this, again, as the oldest person on this podcast, you have this kind of like cycle where you start to become a young adult and you think that you have to get all these things, right? You have to have the right job, the right apartment, drive the right car. And these are the things that kind of create the validation for you as an adult. Mm-hmm. And then as the irony is as I've seen kind of my friends and people in my age bracket kind of, you know, there is this kind of bifurcation. There's people that continue to go down that path of accumulation. But then there's people who go on, you know, my girlfriend just got back from, you know, a missionary trip in India, where she basically was in, you know, third world country slums, and she felt that was an emotional journey for her, right? She has the money and the wherewithal. She could go to a 5-star resort mm-hmm. for a week. She chose that emotional accumulation, right? And so mm-hmm. I think what I see in people is they kind of are wired or they have 2 separate beliefs. They need to have all of these things. Generally, it leads to emptiness, as I've seen. And then they kind of try to overcompensate and fill their lives with more emotional kind of soft, you know, things, whether those are children, whether those are charities, you know, impact things or whatever the deal is. But the irony, I think, is that as people accumulate things, whether it's entitlements to the businesses that they go to, or whether it's entitlements within relationships, right? I think the irony is that I don't know anyone that's truly happy with a lot of things and with this kind of very clear, I always get the best of everything, so I'm the happiest. Like I've never met that person who has accumulated everything, who generally has control or power to affect outcomes and is happy.
And you've seen a lot of like in the tech and
I've Silicon seen Valley. Really successful people, right? And the irony is that the more successful they become, it's almost like they realize that simplicity is the one thing they should have been prioritizing. Mm-hmm. They become successful. They attract all of this resource, all of this wealth or control or power. And then the one thing they really try to create is simplicity and kind of serenity, mm-hmm. right? And serenity and simplicity is not, you don't need millions of dollars and you don't need to be the most powerful person in the world to create those things.
What have you observed outliers that have been able to maybe find some kind of like contentment with amongst abundance? Because it almost seems like we have more abundance, material abundance anyways, or power, or whatever, and you don't actually get what most people think they are trying to get, which is like just enjoy life.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what you see is that you, if you go down the road of accumulation, right, I don't think you ever get to a point where you say, I have everything, because things are constantly changing. You have, you know, the things like technology, you have, you're changing as a human being. So I don't think that there's actually a point where these people, I've never seen contentment, right? And the one thing I have seen is that regardless of wealth, power, the perception of some people having their things together, everyone has fundamentally the same issues, right? They have people in their lives that they wish loved them more. They have people in their lives they wish thought better of them, right? Like those kind of things are, I seem to be durable across socioeconomic and, mm-hmm. and
because that's a first principle of biology.
Yeah.
Is the more people, the better relationships you have, the better connection with your tribe, your group, whatever, the more likely you are to not be exiled from the tribe, which would have been a death sentence in the wild. And
I don't know how my lineage survived.
And you would have had access to mates and food, et cetera. So like that's, it's kind of like a backwards thing. I feel like we all have this drive to want external validation from other humans. We all think that if we acquire more things, we will get that. And that's like the flaw of every rich guy that goes to a matchmaker and gives him 50K and demands some relationship like you talked about the other day, Chris. It's like they just think that they have the money, they have the power, they people should want them. And so they kind of forgo their own personal development and like just being an interesting, cool person and like investing in people. And it's this idea that I'm entitled, I demand, I expect, you should just want me for these other reasons that most people just like most humans don't really care about when you really peel away.
I think, well, or people prioritize the wrong things, right? They think that if I, you know, whether it, look, I mean, people do it with, if I just work out this month every day, my looks will attract the right person. Mm-hmm. If I work hard enough.
Or if I take steroids, I'm going to get all the girls.
Yep. Right. You know, and then, you know, or if I get, you know, if I do plastic surgery, if I'm a woman, right? Yep. If I, you know, if I make this money, if I drive this car, we're constantly bombarded with these kind of, you know, Faustian bargains, right? Where it's, you're going to give a month of your life away, right? Kind of toiling away in the mm-hmm. gym to basically get human interaction. Mm-hmm. And I still maintain one of the funniest things, I don't remember the movie, but it was a Dan Aykroyd line, but like, you know, the most interest, you know, you want to be interesting, be interested, right? Like
yep.
engage with people, talk to them, you know, and have that human connection and do it without an agenda, without kind of that, you know, what's in it for me. But anyway, I mean, I think we're getting off topic, but
that's the thing. That's the harder thing to do. It's like, go out and get in front of people, risk, take risks, fail. Whereas lock myself in a room, make a bunch of money, and then just buy. The idea is like, I'm going to just buy those results or those relationships. Yeah. Right. And that's why those people that do that always run into problems because it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. I will say, you know, it statistically speaking, it's so prevalent that it doesn't work. It's amazing that it's still permeated. It goes to show that in a consumer society like we have, the marketing of that consumer lifestyle is much more effective than kind of the personal or ideological dissemination of kind of a more kind of virtuous lifestyle.
It still drives like the bulk of our economy.
And it's proven insane. Time and time again. The statistics, we've mentioned this on shows before, it's once you make more than $75,000 a year, it doesn't directly correlate with your happiness anymore. Mm-hmm. Other things do, but not your money. Also, you see things like celebrities will commit suicide and you're like, what happened?
Or become drug addicts.
Robin Williams had everything. Why did he do that? It doesn't really work that way.
But so the thing is with someone like Robin Williams is people can't comprehend that. Like, you know, they make their 20-30K a year and they think, oh, he's got millions. Everyone loves him. How could he give that up? But the reality is the things that he had made it even harder for him to come to some kind of like to find some kind of contentment in his life.
Yeah, or relationships. You never know who's after your money.
Well, and it's like, what is the dialogue he probably told himself or the Linkin Park guy? It's like, I have everything. I have talent. I have purpose. I have this or whatever. Why am I still unhappy? There's no point to life. It like almost creates like a nihilistic, predetermined, like there's nothing I can do, it seems like, right?
Well, but I also think it's interesting. I mean, in Robin Williams' instance, but also, you know, people who actually become experts in things, right? The amount of personal and emotional commitment to being Robin Williams. Like, think about I've seen his performances. I mean, he literally would pour his entire soul into things, and that's great. And he will forever be kind of, you know, in our hearts and in our minds as someone who is an amazing human at that, right? But it asks the question, right? What's the cost of expertise, right? What did Malcolm Gladwell say, 10,000 hours?
Yep.
But you know, so if you spend those 10,000 hours to be a cellist, and something that people appreciate and that brings people together. You know, I remember seeing a documentary from Yo-Yo Ma, and someone was talking about, like, you know, do you love your life because all you do is travel around and bring so much joy because you play all these great shows? And he says, I sit on a stage with a chair and my cello. I never talk to the audience. I don't, you know, converse with them. They watch me play music for an hour and a half, and then they all go back and they feel like they've gotten something. But after a while, the applause was kind of, you know, was lacking.
Yeah. And I think that you also get into things like Flow, which the groundbreaking pivotal book everyone should read, Flow by Nihai Chikmazai or whatever, hard to pronounce name, but he talks about how flow is actually a way to find happiness. And I feel like maybe when you get to that point, and like kind of Jim Carrey almost went to this, because like top of his game, you know, so good at whatever, and then just like went off the deep end because he's just he kind of realized that like a lot of it is fleeting or not really what it's meant out to be. But it's like if someone like Robin Williams becomes a master of his craft and then he has no more mountains to climb, no more challenges, no more ways to get into that flow state. For a lot of people, when they can't find flow again, it is severely mentally damaging, right? And I think that could contribute to a lot of, you see these guys that like when Linkin Park was top of their game, and he's in that flow state and he's loving it, it's great. But then when that kind of goes away a little bit, he has trouble kind of coming back to life and saying like, well, what do I do now? Like, you know, I used to love playing the big shows and I would find my flow there or whatever. And I feel like that is, it is kind of part of that like up and down that you get with success, that it's pretty fascinating. And that's why, you know, everybody should be finding flow in some way. And I think that's the really hard thing, because if you have all the money in the world, a lot of flow is connected to kind of making money nowadays. Like some people find it in surfing, sure, or in art or whatever. Like George Bush paints a lot, or Jim Carrey even found it through painting, actually. Like he became a huge painter.
So, right? So to get back to kind of an early human history. So the first guy that built a pyramid, right? The first
pharaoh. Or the first alien that came.
Yeah, right. But do you think that first guy, you know, whatever, it took him, you know, it was probably took 20, you know, 20, 30 years. Do you think he kind of overlooked the thing and said, I thought it'd be better.
Well, that's why they built more than one.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And also he was just kind of standing around watching all the slaves do it, right? What isn't the theory that the Jews built the pyramids? They were basically slaves? Yeah. Or the aliens did, or maybe the aliens were the taskmasters. But just, who knows?
I mean, we're asking this question of, you know, what, like human kind of discontent and focusing on things, right? So think of some of the early human kind of accomplishments, whether it's, you know, the buildings in Greece or, you know, Rome, you know, and all of these accomplishments that we laud, right? Do you think that there was a guy or a group of people or men and women who kind of looked at that accomplishment and was like, hey, I thought it'd be cooler. Like,
well,
we've just given our life to something that's not as cool as we thought.
They have to do it again, or they have to do something bigger.
Right. Or the next group comes along and like, you know, because that guy was so jilted, he didn't go to the next like pyramid builder and be like, hey man, like maybe you want to do something else for the next 20 years. Like, it sounds cool. Like, he probably just said, hey, no, building pyramids is awesome. Like, you should try.
Well, why do they have now like mile high buildings in Dubai? Like, we just constantly bigger, higher, faster, stronger, everything. Like, it's a never ending quest to kind of reach the apex of what humans are capable of. And I, you know, at the individual level, like, it is something that I don't think we've really been able to figure out. Either it seems like you go crazy, you kill yourself, or you like take a painting and lock yourself in a room and paint the rest of your life. Like George Bush's painter now, apparently.
I don't know who said this, but it's the basic premise is, why did you do something amazing? And the answer was, because I can.
Maybe Andy Warhol.
Point is that, you know, as we've looked at human accomplishment throughout the millennia, was there an imperative to why we did these things? Or did it all come down to the fact that we had this idea and we just said, why not? Right. And then as we did it, you know, we continue to kind of follow the same pattern, right? I mean, societies are created and they accomplish amazing things and then they crumble under the weight of them, right? I think that's a durable kind of example and can be kind of what humans do. And so I guess the question I would ask in terms of the ancestral mind and this kind of, you know, obsession with more, what is it going to take for us to kind of break that cycle?
I think that's the answer that we haven't.
Yeah,
that's the big question, right? Yeah. But I do think that the result of all these things are a result of society, money, and basically taking us out of that hunter-gatherer life. And then as you get things like property, people can consolidate, people can get access to basically anything they want through kings and pharaohs and things like that. And then it just basically becomes this man, or a lot of times in history, the man that's at the top, kind of like trying to find some kind of happiness or contentment or legacy to live outside himself, because that's what it was back in the day, like when medieval times, when you realize that like your whole life was focused on finding an heir and making sure that you, like, your lineage moved on or whatever, even though you're going to be dead and it's not really going to matter or whatever. So I think a lot of this stuff is really the byproduct of our modern world, and all the things that come with that. Because if we're in the wild and we're just worried about kind of hanging out with our family and eating meat and procreating and like pretty easy life, bro, you know, but then society sounds, comes along and it's like,
great.
So, well, where should we go from here, Brian? You've been a little bit quiet over there. You just been observing?
Yeah, I've been observing. I was going to say something about Jim Carrey back. If you haven't seen the documentary on him,
the little 9-minute Man video,
the Moon one.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's good too.
It was pretty insane.
Yeah.
But
what about gambling though? Cause like I used to play poker. I was a professional poker player for a while. And I just feel like I would just see people take their bias, their insecurity, all the things that you can read books about. They would literally put it like a mask on their face and just wear it. Right. Well, like,
gambling in particular, for anybody that's not a professional poker player and winning, for the most part, 99.9% of the people that you see in a casino are actively losing their money. But don't think they are. They think they're good enough not to lose their money. So they think, oh, I'm going to see the patterns in blackjack, or, oh, I'm going to see the patterns in the dice. And as long as I don't hit the chips when I throw them, it's great. Like they've got all their little superstitions mm-hmm. and all their little things where they see patterns that aren't there.
But that's gambling. Take us back to poker, though, because poker, I feel like, is most, more appropriate. Right. Poker is a contest versus other people.
Right, but it's the same thing. So most people at the table are not winning players.
Okay.
So it's just like playing against a house. They think they can win. Because they've been conditioned to say, oh, this is a zero-sum game, so as long as I'm better than my opponents, and because of, I'm pretty sure it's Dunning-Kruger, I could be getting it wrong.
Some people don't even think that, though. They like gambling.
Some people do like gambling. But you see the worst of people at a poker table. When you're losing money and you feel like it's because of the factors that are out of your control, you are
what do? You blame.
Your worst. You start to blame dealers. You throw stuff at dealers.
Yep.
You yell at other players for playing bad. Because they beat you, like, oh, you're so stupid, you're so bad.
That's what I'm saying. Like, those examples, but it's not even just that. It's the guy who's winning and thinks he's better than everybody.
Yeah.
Right? Or it's the guy that goes to the table, I see it all the time, with tattoos and he's ripped. And it's like, if you raise him, it's like, oh, how could you raise me? I'm jacked. Like, that type of shit. Like, you see every possible variable when it comes to human beings and nature, and every person has their own little, like, style. Some guys will, like, play more hands. Some will just sit in the corner and wait for a good hand. And, like, but you see all the psychology, I feel like, right on their face. Like, when they're weak, they try to act strong. When they're strong, they try to act weak, right? Like, it's actually fascinating. I feel like we should study the human animal in a casino or a poker table, right? But, like, what are some examples of this in that can kind of translate to life, you know? Because, like, all of these same insecurities and overcompensations and all these things are things we do in our daily life. We just kind of suppress them a little bit more. Whereas at the poker table, it just comes right out.
And I think it's because you're in an emotionally heightened state when you're at the poker table because you attach so much happiness or sadness to having or not having money,
You're trying to suppress other people from, like, you know, reading you, which most people aren't good at, you know, and so they overcompensate.
It's a unique position. I don't know what other heightened emotional states would be comparable to where you could see a human broken down to their base cognitive bias elements, but
reality TV was probably one that would.
I have seen some of the most ridiculous stuff in a casino. Just off the top of my head, I'm going to just tell this story because it's funny. I was the manager on duty for a casino called Calder Casino and Racecourse, which meant that any big decisions had to go through me at that night. It was a rotating position, and it just happened to be this night. It was me. The security manager comes over to me and he says, "Hey, I need you to come do a review. We just banned a guy for life." I'm like, all right. He doesn't tell me anything about the review. Mm-hmm. So I go into the room, and the way this works is I have to basically summarize what I see. They're not allowed to influence me. They're not allowed to say, like, okay, this is what happened. This is what didn't happen. I come in, I watch the surveillance video, and I write down what I see. And now this was a slots machine area. And what I saw was a guy playing a slot machine. And you know how the slot machines used to have the trough down there where the coins would fall out.
Yeah.
But for a period of time there, slot machines still had that, but it was useless. Like, nothing fell out there.
Mm-hmm. Because it's all credits?
Yeah, you got like a little printed out slip, but it was this weird design aesthetic that they still had sitting in the bottom of a slot machine. They're pretty much gone now from the modern slot machines, but this is a good 12 years ago. So maybe not, maybe 10. So anyway, the guy is sitting at the slot machine, unzips his pants, and takes a piss into the trough.
Didn't want to get up and miss those slots.
He pees right
on a heater, man.
Into the trough, re-zips, and continues to press the buttons on the slot machine. Eventually cashes out and then moves on to go play another slot machine. And by the time somebody figures it out, they find him playing in another machine and ban him for life. So yeah, I had to
Brent,
watch that.
That is a funny story. I don't think it has anything applicable to do with what we're talking about today.
Did you talk to the, I'm sorry. I don't care if it's applicable. This is fascinating. Did you talk to this person?
No, I couldn't. I wish I got to talk to this person.
What if he was someone who just said, "Hey man, it looked like one of those urinals and I thought you guys would put them in so we could play gamble dumb. More.
Yeah, the end result is the person was probably drunk, but I saw so much craziness in casinos like that. That is an example of seeing people at their worst, but not an example of an ancestral mindset or why. But I will say that all of that is heightened because of the emotions.
But your question begs this question. Has society and all of the amazing conveniences, has it robbed men of the freedom to urinate wherever we please? Has that been an appropriate trade-off? Because one of my favorite things still to this day is urinating outside. And a really quick caveat, the first time I was ever on Nike's campus, they had all of their buildings on their campus are named after athletes that they endorse. Yeah. And so they had built this media center called the Tiger Woods Center. And it was a 1,000-seat auditorium. It was the nicest. I mean, each one of the 1,000 seats was a high back leather chair. It was one of the nicest things you've ever seen. And we were there as part of a business thing. And I saw this guy urinating in the bushes. And when I came back inside, I said to someone, I go, man, this, and it's a, you know, acres and acres of campus. They're like, yeah, that was Phil Knight. And he just, and I thought to myself, that's the definition of luxury.
Only the CEO can go piss in the bushes.
Well, I was actually pissing in a different bush, but I remember thinking to myself going like, hey, you know, even a billionaire likes to do that. I guess I must be, you know, doing the right thing.
That's a good book too. Shoe Dog. You guys should read it.
Great, great book.
So let's move on to something else. We got a couple things here and I'm going to read them off and you guys can decide. We got the sickness of being famous and external validation.
I think we just covered.
What to do when you aren't. Yeah, but I was thinking more social media and some of that stuff. What to do when you aren't feeling well. Like today, I just not feeling good and I'm kind of coming off a cold, but I do want to work out. I don't know if I should. I don't know. Maybe you guys can talk about some strategies you have when you're not feeling great. Various topics in life, how to live ancestrally, evolutionary biology, how that ties into relationships, pitfalls of the mind, and I got some other things here, recycling, climate change, plant-based, etc.
Social media.
We have a 4-hour episode planned today, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, social media.
We're doing a telethon. Please call in with donations.
So there's actually a Netflix on this about like kind of social media stars and some of the nonsense that goes with that.
Well, let me interject here because as the older guy here, like at what point did you become aware of, like, what was your, was MySpace your first social network? Was Friendster? Like, what was your first account?
It was MySpace.
Were you on AOL?
I was on ICQ.
Yeah, I was on AOL and AIM.
Yeah.
I definitely had AIM. Mm-hmm.
Okay, which is basically the beginning of, you know, kind of sharing. Is like, you know, AIM is the precursor to Twitter, right? You know?
Yeah, I guess you had your away message on AIM. I was on ICQ because that was where the magic community at the time was taken place. America Online, same thing. I would go into the chat rooms on America Online and like yell at people and stuff. And
I didn't get big into chat. I went a few times. I'm just like, this is weird. And I didn't go.
Yeah, it was strange.
But I used AIM a lot. In fact, I remember Mike Lockie. I remember AIMing with him. Or was it messaging? What do you even call it nowadays? Like, it's basically what iMessage is today. And it was actually an amazing tool. I feel like it could even be alive today. Like, does AIM still exist?
No, they just shut it down last year.
But here's the thing. So I worked at Time Warner when we merged with AOL. And so now that you have things like Slack, we all used AIM for effectively purpose, right? I mean, that was the kind of inner office communications that you didn't want in email. So it was like, hey, I'm hungover from last night. Can you guys cover for me? Or, you know, I'll meet you down here in this point. You know, it was funny. You know, so with that, at what point when you guys were kind of, you know, in your own lives, at what point did social media, the tipping point for social media for you guys?
It was smartphones.
Smartphones?
Yeah. And I think before that, like this was more the internet than it was even, this is not even social media. It's just the internet. Social media really took off with the iPhone, at least in our country. Right.
Sure. But I guess I'm asking more like for you personally, like, so I remember mine was MySpace, right? And I owned a marketing company and I had to hire people in all these different parts of the country. And it was really hard because, you know, you had services and all these really kind of like disparate things. And I'm actually still friends with these people. This is over 12, 13 years ago, but I had hired these two girls in Seattle, Washington, and they did a great job. And I told them I had all this other opportunity for them. And I said to them, I said, I've emailed you, I've called you, you're not responding. And they're like, we're on MySpace. And they literally in the Magnolia Hotel, you know, on Fifth Street in Seattle, they set up my MySpace page. And I literally hired people without ever meeting them on a computer in the mid 2000s, and I'm still friends with, you know, half a dozen. Like, I met great people
through MySpace.
Right. And it was really kind of, and I remember thinking to myself going like, wow, like the ability to create a digital facsimile of yourself has utility. Now, obviously, you know, there was a million other things that came out of that, but.
Yeah. I mean, I used MySpace and I never got super into it. I think.
Did you have custom page?
Yeah. I don't know. I have no idea.
I used to do a lot of blogging on LiveJournal, and then I switched over to
MySpace. Oh, that was the big one. I remember in high school, everyone was like, did you read Josh's LiveJournal? I'm like, what the f-?
Like
what
Gibson?
What are you guys talking? No, like dude, like
you
high
can't
school.
Cover
friends.
The mic and get rid of it. You
I was going to cover the mic to get rid of the curse word, but just edit that out, editor. So that might have been I guess it is a form of social media, right?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, and that was definitely one that was taken off in. But again, that was like the internet and the genesis of the internet one and how the internet started affecting our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the fascinating, if you really want to, what's the
book? Tila Tequila. That is the first person I remember becoming a social media star.
Well, what I was going to ask around MySpace is, would you ever request people you didn't know?
Yeah. Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that was, I mean, if you really think about it like that, like we talked about the chat rooms in AOL, right? Which was the beginnings of that, but you didn't really know who you were talking to. And, right. And the joke is right. Like every 15-year-old boy was talking to an 80-year-old man who was pretending to be a 12-year-old girl. But, but you know, like MySpace with this kind of like presence, like that was the thing that kind of, you know, blew my mind. And then, you know, if you think about kind of what social media could be, right? This great connection, this ability, you know, probably.
Well, I think it is, but I think it's got a bunch of layers of BS on top of it.
Well, I think it's changed. I guess the point I was going to make is I remember 2013, 2014, 2015, I was really busy with work, and Facebook was really kind of my lifeline into my social network, like my social groups thing. So my friends were getting married or having a baby or, you know, and I kind of felt like loosely, like now I won't go on Facebook, right? Like, and when I look at things like Twitter and Instagram, you cultivate your feed and you know, Instagram is really entertainment. Twitter is really, for me, news and business, right? But like, I kind of always wonder, am I using it right? Am I getting the most out of these things? You know, blogs, like, you know, Medium is something that I look at a lot. But like how, I guess the question, I think the next evolution of this stuff is that, you know, as people are just, you know, becoming famous, what's the next utility for this stuff? And how does it become like, you know, you've heard about a lot of these social networks that are happening that are smaller, like the ones that are in your neighborhood or, you know, Mothers or
Mastodon.
Yeah. So I guess the question is that, you know, do you guys see a path forward or do you think it's going
to? Well, what I also want to talk about is I don't know what it's going to turn into. But I do know what is already happening today. And I think Instagram is kind of the apex of this right now, right? Because every young kid, like Gary Vee talks about this a lot, like every young kid that's 20 wants to be a social media influencer. So they can like travel the world and take pictures and videos and whatever, right? Like that's the new thing. Like kids don't want to go to college and become lawyers. They want to become influencers.
Nobody wants to be an astronaut anymore.
But even beyond that, like you have the average person that is like maybe their health coach or this, or even now businesses, everybody wants more likes. They want more. They want fame, right? And then the real toxicity of this stuff, I think, is when everyone wants to, like this younger generation, basically wants to become famous and think that is the point itself. If I can have 10,000 followers and 500 likes per picture, then I'll have it made and that'll be my life or whatever. And it's like, that's obviously not accurate.
Doesn't provide
and then, anything. But then the sickness of having access to so many people, having people that can go on your picture and say, I love you, and then have people say I hate you on the same picture, and like all the things that go with that, right? That's not even like the ability to have other humans kind of verbally abuse us so quickly and so often is not something our species would have ever dealt with. Like that's not something you did. In fact, and from an ancestral perspective, the way you would really kind of deal with someone that was kind of going out of line is you would gossip about them, and then you would even do things like publicly shaming. In fact, real quick, real quick before we get to that, hunters, and there's some tribes that have been observed by modern day anthropologists, like maybe in the 60s or 70s, they had this process known as shaming the meat. So if a hunter came back with a slab of meat or a kill or whatever, he would have to publicly offer it up as like, oh, here's my pitiful catch or whatever. And then the rest of the tribe would be like, oh, you're going to give us that little piece of meat or whatever. Like they would do things to publicly shame it as a way to basically bring his ego down. And this is something that was probably very ubiquitous over a lot of different peoples and cultures or whatever. It was one of those things that just like humans figured out to do in a social setting to make sure that nobody rised up in stature. Like if one guy is really good at hunting and he just brings home food all the time, it would be very easy for him to now take access to all the mates and basically push people out, decide who gets the food or whatever. And humans figured out from a group survival perspective that you can't do that. It didn't work. Like group survival does not work if there's anybody that's higher than anybody else. And so,
you're saying the clapback has been around since the beginning
of time. What's a clapback?
Well, coming back, you know, kind of cutting people down to size and kind of, you know, telling
people. Well, no, it definitely is. And I think we're seeing that today on social media as well, like you were going to say. So why do we have outrage culture, Brent? Why do we have outrage culture, Brent?
It sounds like outrage culture is directly related to this thing. So outrage culture tends to target those that are famous. So when somebody famous either did something in the past or does something now that can be loosely attacked in any way, shape, or form, you'll see just giant groups of people jump on that. And it has to be related to that need to knock down the famous people a peg.
Because it's easier to be lazy and critical than it is to be supportive and equally kind of motivated.
Yeah, like, you know, yelling at Kevin Hart was a prime example. Like he didn't host the Oscars because they found a tweet from 9 years ago that was...
You've got to be kidding me. I honestly don't want to hear the story because I'm going to get outraged and want to just punch people in the face. I can't stand this kind of bullshit.
No, he made a comment that if his son was gay, he would like shake it out of him or something. Beat him out. I don't remember what he said, but
he's a comedian.
He was a comedian and he made a joke and he had previously apologized for it. So when it came up, he was like, what are you talking about? I said that that was a little bit insensitive at the time.
I wouldn't apologize.
And
that's the problem. That's
the Oscars said he had to apologize if he wanted to host the show. And he said, okay, no, I go find somebody else. And yeah. Then he even apologized afterwards, but he quit the show first. And then he was
good.
Like,
there needs to be principles for this garbage. I hope this is just a fad that goes away because I can't stand it. Can't stand all this outrage culture bullshit. Like I made a post the other day about the things that people should be outraged for are like our pharmaceutical industry, our student debt, the politics and the political landscape and all the BS that goes along with that, our food system and how they can literally put like in McDonald's fryers, there's when they fry fries, formaldehyde is one of the byproducts of that process. Like there is so much, and that's even if they're supposed to be replacing their oil every week and you know they're not. Like there's so much garbage that people should be outraged with, and it's not what someone's comment on social media is and whether it was racist or not. Like,
I promise you the people who said that about Kevin Hart felt exactly as strongly as you do about this, about those
but
other
the difference
items.
Is they're morons.
There you go. Succinctly said. I was just thinking, though, the irony is that someone listening to the Ancestral Mind podcast is probably going to be pretty self-motivated, pretty in tune with kind of personal development and kind of the, you know, evolution of becoming a better human or at least being in touch with that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. The irony is that so our listeners are not necessarily the people this really applies to. It's
right.
I remember when Donald Trump in the summer of 2016, when he was getting all of this steam, I was really confused by it because I don't think it took a Nobel laureate in, you know, economics or kind of governmental systems to recognize that, you know, Trump was just, he is not the most intellectually gifted human being that has ever run for elected office. Just say that.
He does have the best words, though.
He does have the best words. I asked this older person who'd seen a thing or two, and I said, well, what is the phenomenon? And he just said, look, like there's a lot of people in the life that hate their life, that are miserable. Mm-hmm. And they feel like, well, you know what, like, he tells me that it's not my fault. It's brown people's fault or it's these people's fault. And it's easier for people to be outraged and look for excuses and blaming other people than it is to look at themselves and say, I'm a 65-year-old janitor and I never tried. And now at the twilight of my life, I'm bitter.
Yeah.
Right. And so as I think about people who go, they're outraged over Kevin Hart or people who just throw, you know, salt all day on social media, I would imagine if you were to create a Venn diagram of those people and people who really don't apply themselves or really have care about their own lives, like it would be an overlapping circle.
Right, right.
So actually, I'm curious, what is the ancestral evolutionary psychology reason why we love to blame people? I mean, it's come so innate to our species. In fact, I bet you it's the us versus them. Let's think about that. So us versus them. Remember we talked about how that, I told you what would... If you were to come across a tribe of humans and like your tribe's over here and they're over there and you've never seen them before, you don't even speak the same language. And I asked you, Brent, how would you best respond to that situation?
Yeah. Well, we said we needed to be cautious in those spots.
Extremely cautious, right?
Very likely to because try and kill you.
If you come across 10 random wild peoples in nature, and if you're not extremely cautious to everyone, well, maybe 9 of the times they're peaceful and you're fine. But the one time that they're not and they're cannibals or they want to steal your women and children, you're basically weeded out of the gene pool. So we are built to be tribalistic. We're built to be, I mean, we're basically built to be racist. Like, it's kind of ingrained into us, because if someone is different from us, we shouldn't trust them because we don't know if they want to kill and eat us. That's kind of like the evolutionary reason why we are this way. Now, I think that would help a lot of people if they just understood why humans are this way, instead of like blaming people and making it more about us versus them, because then maybe we can overcome our psychology and work together, because the next epoch of human evolution is going to have to be overcoming our tribal tendencies. What do you guys think about that?
We need to overcome them in some fashion, and we need to kind of give into what our natural state is in others, like you say when you're doing like the food situation. But yeah, overcoming the innate reasons behind generalizations and all that stuff. Like, we, they're all racism. They're all part of heuristics and everything.
Yeah, they're all, it's bias, and a lot of it's dogma.
They don't serve us anymore.
They don't. Exactly. It's because, again, it's a mismatch. Just like our food system is mismatched. Our genes and how we live in boxes is mismatched. Like, even like sex 3.0, how we have monogamous relationships that everybody thinks is normal is not natural. It's a mismatch to the way humans are designed, which is why 50% divorce rate, most people cheat, yet they lie about it, like, all, and all the things that go along with that. So
I recommend the Joe Rogan skit on his first Netflix special about the Instagram models. It really does.
Is it the first one or is it the second?
It's in his first one where he's talking about, he's like, there's a girl on Instagram with a million people who just follow her, and all she posts is pictures of her ass. And he goes on and on and on, but he's making such valid points.
This is a
new
species. He's like, this is a new species. Yeah. So what can we do about it? Like, how can we avoid just the outrage and the nonsense? Like, and I made a post recently about politics, and it's just like, people, they can't come to common ground. I feel like that's the biggest issue. Remember I told you about how Charlie Munger, he says that you should never argue against something until you can argue for it better. Like, that should be like something we all do. Obviously, no one's going to do that, right?
Right.
It's hard. It takes mental energy. But it's like, if we could first find the things that are truisms that we can all agree on, and then kind of talk about the things around it and find if there's ways to do things or whatever, like, that could be productive. Instead, people devolve into like ad hominem, straw man, like all these fallacies that we fall into, because people just like get into this mode where they think it's me versus you. My ideas versus your beliefs, and now I need to defend whatever I'm saying and counterpoint whatever you're saying, but it should be the exact opposite. We should try to converge in the middle as best as we can.
Yeah.
Well, but, I mean, let's go back to what we talked about. You know, Brent talked about gambling, right? I mean, people inherently have a bias that they think they know more than the next guy.
Yes.
Right? And so, you know, they think, I have an opinion, and I've arrived at that opinion through thought and experience, and because it's in my head and because it's mine, or I, you know, I'm going to assign a value to it, and I'm going to discount whatever you think. And the irony is that the people that I seem to see as the happiest are the people that don't have an ego around being right, and more have a motivation about being informed, right? Like having
questioning.
Yeah. And a plethora of inputs, right? Mm-hmm. And asking questions, not to debunk, but to learn, right?
Well, that's why you said a lot of tech people are like philosophy majors, right? Like Socratic method, ask questions, like admit that, as Socrates said, that you know nothing. And that's why I'm wise, because I know nothing, or I admit that I know nothing. And it's like, but it's counterintuitive to the default person, right?
I'm going to admit to something. One of my favorite things to do is argue with my smartest friends about the opposite of what they think so that I can get the best information from them.
Yeah, that's
good. I do this to Kareem all the time. Yeah. I will argue with him against like a progressive policy or something that he likes, and I will just start throwing stuff at him, and he gets so mad at me because I don't have any facts to back up anything. I'm just making him argue, and then I take that information and I go argue the other side with other people, and I repeat his information to get their side of it. It's
but most people can't do that. That's a problem. They cannot. Oh, so what is that quote? It's like, a sign of intelligence is being able to hold conflicting ideas in your mind at the same time.
And not have your head explode.
Yeah, right? Most people cannot deal with dissonance. So, Brent, and what is cognitive dissonance? We talked about this in our show, the other show.
Yeah, cognitive dissonance is dissonance comes up when you can't, the idea is that you can't accept the thing that is accurate, so you continue to ignore it.
Well, and fundamentally, what it's something that challenges your belief system.
Yeah, well,
any idea that challenges your belief system.
One of the ways it comes from, yeah.
Right, so people can't say, I believe this, you over here are telling me this that is contrary to that, How can I even entertain the idea that you might be right? Most people can't do that.
No.
They can't even tell themselves what if you're right, right? Because it's so painful to their ego, to their mind, or whatever. And then you get people that get wrapped up in their ego and their identity. And if you say anything that challenges that, you're basically attacking their character. But again, evolutionarily, this is a survival mechanism. Why? Because we talked about what is the evolutionary niche that humans carved out in the wild, Brent?
Wait, ask Chris. I know the answer because you asked me this on every episode.
Well, I'm just reaffirming. So, Chris, what do you think the primary evolutionary niche that humans carved out that's different from every other animal species? Mostly different.
The ability to recognize their own visage in a reflection.
Yeah, because I don't even know what he just said right there, but it's group survival.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you look at one of our closest ancestors, the chimps, the only thing they can do in a group collectively, and even then it's kind of a shit show, is hunt monkeys. Like when they're chasing monkeys, they'll kind of like break off and they'll corner it and they'll do things, but it's still kind of like every man for himself type of thing. They're not good at doing anything in a group. Humans, we basically figured out how to work together in a group to hunt and then share. And then all these byproducts you get of why we have tribalism, because the better that our group can function as like a single unit, the more likely we are to hunt better and the more protected we are against invaders and outsiders.
But there are other animals that have pack mentality, right? I mean, we're not unique in that respect.
We're unique in the egalitarian group survival niche.
Okay. Yeah, there's always an alpha in the pack. And
yeah, and like some other species, they'll move in packs, but that's just sheer numbers, protection by numbers. And some, they'll like push the penguin off the rock to like save themselves and things like that. Like, so there's just no other species that will work together and form those bonds the way humans do. And that's like a big part of our evolution, how we were able to hunt collectively. And then we started cooking and controlling fire and all these things. Fascinating stuff. But let's end the show. I don't know, with something. Let's just end the show with something. What do you got anything? You got anything interesting?
What? So if we are, as social media and the rise of the self has happened, what is going to be the water? Will it be a natural disaster like global warming? Will it be a nuclear war? What will be the catalyst to drive us back into a collaborative community structure, you know, kind of living as a tribe, as opposed to, you know, all of the little kind of independent?
Well, I think the hope is that the internet will help us overcome our biology in that way. And we see it to some extent. Like now.
So you don't think that there will be a catalytic?
I hope there won't be. If I had to bet that there would be, I'd probably put it like 50-50, right? And some people will say either it's going to be a super bug from the use of our antibiotics. It's another like massive flu epidemic. It's going to be nuclear war. It's going to be AI. Like there's a lot of things that they're talking about that might happen. But
so I guess a cleaner way to ask the question, will it take a major culling of the number of people alive for us to get back to that? Or can we find a way forward?
If aliens invade.
We need Thanos.
If aliens invade, I'm telling you, that's the answer. You want to know why it would change everything for the human species? Because we would have a common enemy. Because it would be the first time where it doesn't matter if you're Arab, you're white, you're this, you're that. You're human. We're collectively humans.
Right.
And you're aliens. You're collectively our enemy.
What happens if the aliens showed up and then like, I'm trying to think of like who are the most disrespected group of people on the planet?
Well, I would probably say the Jews have had it the most from.
Well, it depends on which
universal.
Are you talking about like today?
Today,
maybe gypsies.
Yeah, at the risk of being incredibly racially insensitive.
Yeah,
like if the aliens came down and they said, "Hey, Filipinos, they're the aliens' like representatives or whatever," and would do you think that all of human society would turn on them as the aliens? Like, how would that work?
I think if aliens weren't hostile, then it would be the things that would happen if they chose Filipinos for whatever reason. Yeah, Filipinos would definitely.
But if they said no, power. You guys like they were alien ancestors. Like it came down.
Oh well, then I think it would be like the rest of humanity versus the Filipinos
and
aliens.
That's what I'm asking.
No, it definitely would be that because again, anything that could give us a very defining us versus them would be universal to every human being.
Do you think that we as a society would have the ability to actually evaluate if let's say they came down and it's unclear if they're hostile or not hostile. Mm-hmm. Do you think we'd have the patience to figure that out? Or do you think we would just be like, we don't understand it, kill it?
Well, I think that's like every alien invading show. It's like part of the drama. Like what's the recent one with Amy, what's her name? Or where like it's the glass wall Contact or
no?
Oh, it was similar to Contact though. Yeah,
that was. It's actually a great movie.
It is a really good movie.
It was good. I don't know why I can't think of the name of it, but it Contact is in my mind because they were very similar, like slow burns. The real answer is that doesn't matter because we're in a simulation, so we're not going to find that. And not running into alien life is the primary reason that we are more likely to be in a simulation than
not. So, Brent, since you're talking about the simulation, what explain that for the rest of people.
So I don't remember the name.
The idea behind it. Because Elon Musk thinks we are in a simulation.
It's more likely that we are than we're not because alien life is one of the primary reasons. We haven't found any evidence of alien life yet. So,
what do you mean alien life is one of the primary reasons?
I'm getting there.
That's the Fermi paradox, though.
Yes. So that is the reason is the paradox is that we are either the first intelligent life in the entire universe, which is extremely unlikely, in which case we're probably not in a simulation, or there's some giant filter that kills everybody before they can, that kills intelligent life before they can get to another planet or get to contact with other intelligent life. Which we haven't run into. We don't know what this giant great filter is. Maybe it's just a radiation outside or whatever the case, we can't overcome it. Or the planet gets destroyed before you can get off of it in time.
Well, how does the Fermi paradox get tied into that? Because that's the idea that the universe expands so aggressively that there could be civilizations we could just will never be able to reach or know that are even there.
Sure. There's also the fact that they may be intentionally avoiding us because we are not on a certain level. It's like the Star Trek thing with the Prime Directive, where you're not allowed to talk to a pre-warp civilization and affect them in any way. And then the other option is that our simulation has only been programmed for human life. So, and of all of those, like we should have seen some indication of other life. And I don't remember what the percentages are, but that's why Elon Musk says it's more likely that we're in a simulation.
Well, he talked about it that kind of explains why and how we could be in a simulation that kind of resonated with me. So he basically said, if you look at computer games today and the advancement of technology, there's going to be a point where a digital world is, you can't delineate it from the real world. Like in some way, whether it's VR or like immersion or whatever, there's like, that's bound to happen.
So Westworld,
San
Junipero. Right, exactly. So he basically says that if that is what's going to happen, if we just keep going forward, then the likelihood that it's already happened and then some kid, you know, basically created a Sims, and this is like one of the Sims worlds and we're in it, is actually very likely because of the timelines of just like in the infinite amount of time there is like
that the universe is. We would have to be the first ones that came up with everything. Right. Same thing with intelligent life. Same, like if we are first or we're unique, then we're not in a simulation. This is real life.
Well, the actual question then becomes, would you take the red or blue pill, Brent? Which one was the one where you go?
I don't know which one makes you like figure it out, but I would have stayed in that. Did you see the world outside the Matrix?
It was the worst. Exactly. That's what I think every single time. I would love to be in the Matrix and I would like be eating.
I mean, I want to know that I can like run around and do flips and stuff. So I want to take whatever pill gives me the advantage of like slowing down time and all that cool stuff. But I don't want to leave. I want to stay in there.
Right. See, I don't know if I believe the simulation part, but I do believe the movie Inception always really stuck with me. About the ability for people to, you know, kind of have this dream state or whatever the deal is. Mm-hmm. And then in that question, the question is which plane of consciousness are we on? And are we on our own? Or are we a figment? Are we a figment of someone else's?
Mm-hmm. You got to take some DMT or ayahuasca to figure that out.
Yeah. But even then, I would say you're not actually figuring out.
No, you're just
altering the code in this simulation. And then it's creating these things that your brain is telling you you actually know or see, but it's all just a figment of my imagination, which could all just be numbers, like green numbers on a screen, right?
Yeah.
Like, so, and then fundamentally, it all comes down to the simple fact that, like, as far as we know it in this matrix, in this world, we are going to die at some point unless we solve aging, which I'm really hoping we do, which is one of my motivations for making a lot of money so I can have access to that technology before anyone else.
I don't think our generation is going to solve we may be able to upload.
I disagree, and that might just be because I'm biased because I want to live forever, but I disagree. And
as we spoke about earlier, cognitive dissonance.
So, let's wrap the show up. And I want to thank Chris for coming on the show. And
I added nothing.
And we'll have him back some other time. Maybe he'll actually tell you who he is or what he does. Because I asked. Never. He still didn't.
Well, where can there. We like? You have like a social media presence?
No, he doesn't.
Nope, nothing.
Okay. All right.
So, in fact,
in between the Matrix.
In fact, guys, Chris is like one of those agents that walks around in the Matrix with the guns and he just kind of goes in and out of both worlds. He's a good example of how to best act in today's world of social media and how to avoid the pitfalls. Because I'm on social media and Instagram kind of sucks me in sometimes. I know it definitely has a negative effect on people around me. Brent, you're more Twitter? Like, what do you do on social?
I am very disconnected from social media. So, like...
But you're on Twitter, which I think... Which, for me, has no appeal whatsoever. I can't stand Twitter. Anytime I go on Twitter, I just want to comment on people's stupid things they say.
I am on Twitter. I have a lot of followers on Twitter. But I don't do a lot of interaction on Twitter. So... A lot of people follow me because of the crypto podcast, and right. that is
but basic. You don't use it then.
I didn't use Twitter once before I started the crypto podcast a year ago, so I have like 5,000 followers or whatever just from that. So it's not like even a ton, and I schedule a lot of my posts. I try to interact where I can with the people that are interesting, but I also constantly block people anytime they're.
But even like that's a waste of time, man. Like, it's a waste of time. In fact, Kyle Newport's new book, Digital Minimalism, is something that everybody should read. It's basically like, take social media, find out what actually brings you utility and happiness. Like, you mentioned how you, when you're working a lot, use Facebook to kind of keep up with friends and family. There's a way where you can like alter your newsfeed and like only show friends of friends and do things where Facebook could be like a once a week thing where you actually get that utility, right? Yeah. Most people can't do that though. They get sucked into all the nonsense or whatever. And
I use Discord.
Like newsfeed blockers, something you can do on Facebook, etc. But to close out, I got a book to recommend, and then we'll figure out a call to action for the audience today. The book that I highly recommend everyone read is The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. This is one of those books that was similar to The Vegetarian Myth that is a must read. If you still think that fat is bad for you, if you still think that meat causes cancer or anything like that, you have to read this new up-to-date analysis of the technology and the science, and just see how much of a conspiracy it's been for the past 40 years and how it's a large reason why our country is so fat and sick today. And so, in a nutshell, healthy meat, healthy, lots of saturated fat, even fat as the bulk of the nutrition in your diet, is the way the human animal is designed. We are not designed to eat carbs and sugar. A low carb diet with plenty of animal products is going to be the best diet, period. And then we won't get into plant-based. That's maybe for another show. I want to kind of debunk the idea that plants are the healthiest thing to eat, because they are not, pound for pound. Plants are not the healthiest food you can eat, which is kind of surprising.
Calm down. You're going to get into
it
later.
It's kind of surprising that people still talk about it so much, but that's a lot of politicking around that and why that is. So what is our call to action today? Let's get the audience to just do one thing. Any recommendations?
Do not pee on slot machines. That is going to be my recommendation for this show. No. Okay,
well, look. I'm going to come up with something better than that, because that is just not good, Brent.
My call to action is, have one conversation with a complete stranger without an agenda. Don't go up and, don't flirt with anybody, but just talk to a stranger at a coffee shop or in line somewhere and just ask them a question and listen without the initiative to respond.
And maybe ask them a follow-up question, and I would say be interested.
Yeah.
In them.
But don't worry about what you're going to say. And if they have a difference of opinion, don't try to sway them. Don't try to offer anything.
Yeah.
Just try to absorb the information.
You want to really drive that home. Maybe even say, don't respond. Like, just do the silence and let them keep talking.
Brent, why do you just got to be weird?
Because I'm
going to fire you today.
I've been fired six times
already.
And
I'm going to rehire you for the next show. But no, wait, you're fired after you edit this episode, but then you're fired until the next episode.
Not that our audience needs to figure this out, but of the three of us, Colin is unabashedly the weirdest person in this conversation.
I have no response, but it doesn't mean you're right. Absence of my response does not mean you're accurate. Okay, guys, thanks for watching. Make sure you send us show recommendations to ancestralmind@gmail.com or info@wildfoods.co. Make sure you like and subscribe on iTunes. And what else do they do? Oh, disclaimer. We didn't really talk about nutrition. I guess I did.
We didn't really, but if we did, we're not nutritional advisors.
We're not. Do so at your own risk, if you, et cetera, et cetera. And then also, this show does not represent
Wild Foods
ideas or whatever. Like, how does that one go?
The views and opinions expressed in this episode do not reflect Wild Foods Co. Remember, though, this is where you can get real food, real ingredients. And that
use
is
code disclaimer and an advertisement. Use code AMPODCAST12 for 12% off your entire order. Thanks for watching, guys. That's a wrap.